Well, thank you for showing up today and not taking a nap after lunch. We appreciate your showing up here today. I'm Janet Roloff. I've been with Science News and its affiliated properties for almost 40 years. So for me, science is a way of life. I do environmental reporting, have done it for over 35 years, but always in the context of science journalism. I realize that there are a number, as a founder of this organization, by the way, I realize that there are a number of people within SEJ who aren't as wedded to science being a part of every story they do to the extent I am. I'm trying to proselytize to those who don't or reassure those who do that it can strengthen your stories if you do. And don't just take my word for it. I brought three very experienced people on our panel today to show that there are others besides me who think that this is the way to go. We'll start out on my left, I guess your right, with Sarah Zielinski here. She's covered earth and environmental sciences for Smithsonian Magazine's website. Her work has also appeared in Slate, Science, Scientific American, Discover, and National Geographic News. She has a blog called Wild Things on all things weird and wonderful in the natural world. It appears on our sister publication, Science News. And since agreeing to appear on our panel, Sarah has accepted my plea to formalize her role, and she's now the managing editor for my magazine, Science News for Students. Sarah has a degree in biology from Cornell with a concentration on ecology and evolution, and she has a master's in journalism from Dan's program at NYU. She is a winner of a News Brief Award from the DC Science Writers Association. And she is really a skilled writer and reporter. We're very happy to have her. Next to her is Dan, and he probably needs as little introduction as any of us here, but I'll give it anyway. He's a 25-year member and former president of SEJ. And he not only teaches journalism these days, but also directs NYU's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program and Science Communication Workshops. His best-selling book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Did you hear that? Science and Salvation? Won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize, in addition to a host of other awards, including ones from SEJ and the National Academy of Sciences. He continues to write for a range of publications, including New York Times and Scientific American, and his new book project is about, he said, monarch butterflies and the future of biodiversity in the Anthropocene. Before joining NYU in 2005, Dan was the environmental writer at Newsday for 14 years. There he was twice the principal member of reporting teams that were Pulitzer finalists. And like Chris and me, he has entered journalism without a formal degree in science. And then we have, to my right and your left, Chris Joyce. He works on the science desk at NPR, showing again that you don't need a science degree to do award-winning science journalism. In 24 years at NPR, he has reported from remote villages in the Amazon and Central American rainforests. He's been at Tibetan outposts in the mountains of Western China and the bottom of an abandoned copper mine in Michigan's UP. His stories covered volcanoes, hurricanes, human evolution, tagging giant bluefin tuna, climate change, wildfires, sort of everything. For 8 years, he was an editor and correspondent for Radio Expeditions, an NPR documentary program on natural history and disappearing cultures and environments. He's written two nonfiction books on science topics for the popular market. He can tell you about those later. And before coming to NPR, he worked for 10 years as a U.S. correspondent and editor for one of my competitors, New Scientist magazine, which comes out of England. Chris's stories have won awards from the Overseas Press Club, Alfred I. DuPont, Columbia University Journalism Competition, and Society of Professional Journalists, also the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Oh, and 2 weeks ago, he also picked up the 2016 National Academy of Sciences Award for Broadcast Journalism. Good job. Okay, so what I'd like to do is, first of all, try and catalyze maybe a little discussion with the audience here by asking each of these people on the panel to just tell us a little bit about how science has informed some of their stories, why it has sort of strengthened what their stories might have been like without it, if I can do that. Maybe, Chris, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, as a science reporter first, I spent about 80% of my time on the desk writing about science and 20% on the environment, I'd say, but most of the environment stuff I do comes out of the scientific community. So I cover ecology, for example, but, you know, ecology is the basis for so much of environmental reporting. Climate change, obviously. And that's my starting point for most of my stories. I like to look for stories from the scientific literature or from people in academia, people sometimes in environmental groups, even people in industry sometimes who are doing interesting things. And I find that relying on science, in a sense, gives me cover, really, because it lends validity to the reporting that I do. I just came back 3 weeks ago from a trip to the Sequoia National Forest, where I was following biologists from Berkeley who were are measuring the effects of drought on trees, giant sequoias in particular, in the Sierras, watching how they go about understanding the effects of drought on trees, which actually, to my surprise, is not well known. How do trees die from drought? They actually die from cavitation, so like an embolism in the inside the tree that's caused when air gets into the tree. They die from starvation because in order to protect themselves from heat and something called vapor pressure deficit, which I won't go into too much, but they close off the stomata in their leaves. The stomata, well, I've got one. I burned myself the other day, but the little holes in the leaves is how they breathe, right? So how they take in carbon dioxide, and in order to protect themselves, they close that off. These processes basically have been revealed in the past 10 or 15 years. And are not widely known, but in order to tell the public what's really going on with the trees in California because of the drought, you've got to find out how it works. Furthermore, from that you can talk about, well, what sort of solutions are there? I mean, it's a drought. What can we possibly do? Climate change is possibly changing the environment for trees. Well, it's not without hope. You can clear forests, thin them. Fewer straws in the ground means more water for each of the trees that survive. Which trees survive best? What kind of soil? These are questions that only scientists can ask. And for me, you go there first and then figure out how that informs policy.
Okay. Sarah, let me go to you next.
Sure. Thanks, Jenna, and thanks for asking me to be on this panel. If I just get up and run out, it's because I'm about to go into a coughing fit because I've got a cold, not because I don't like all of you. I come from a world of science. That is my background. I grew up in high school. I was intending to be a marine biologist, and I changed my mind after I got my degree, but I still, everything, my worldview comes from science, and I constantly have to remind myself that the rest of the world does not work like me. And I want to start off with just kind of an example of something that I was reading this morning in The Guardian. There was a columnist who was arguing that to save elephants, we need to open up the ivory trade. We don't need to ban it. And it's an interesting argument, but he had no data. There was no science. There was just a bunch of logic, which sounded really great. But once you start looking more at the world of science, you realize that the world doesn't really work that way. Things that you have these logical arguments, but just because something is logical, something because it's obvious, that doesn't make it true. And so science for me helps me to sort out between the what sounds really great and what is actually real. With the elephants and the ivory, which is something that I've been writing about, from the perspective of science, there are many perspectives to write to tackle this argument. There are people who cover it, covering it from the side of everything from terrorism to the art world. But for me, everything has to be based in science. I call myself a science writer long before I called myself an environmental journalist. And for me, it adds that bit of context that it just to my entire world, actually, that is often kind of missing from a lot of things. We have a lot of people in this world that are just talking. We don't have a lot of data. We don't have a lot of evidence. And the science world, scientists, that's where you can go to get it, which isn't to say that science gives you true answers. Science does not give you that ever, which is kind of the frustrating part of covering science. But it does help you add some really important context to all of this. I don't have much else to say.
Okay, Dan, you've been in a couple different positions here. You've been a writer, you're a teacher, you're an author. To you, how important is science as an environmental journalist?
Right. Well, it's incredibly important. First of all, thanks, Janet, for inviting me, and it's an honor to be on a panel with three terrific journalists. And I have to say, it's really a pleasure to follow Sarah, somebody who I first got to know in my own classroom, and it's just nothing makes me happier than seeing people who I taught become just spectacular environmental science health writers. So it's great. So there are a lot of things to say about this topic, and I'll not say them all, so we can have plenty of time for discussion. But I think one of the most important things to think about when you're talking about, you know, science as an element of environmental journalism is that we really, I think, need to stop thinking about science as an other, you know, as something else. And you're like, well, I have to go get the science and put it into my story. I think that's completely wrongheaded. And the right approach that will lead to stronger stories and also more readable stories as well as more credible stories is to think of science as a way of thinking, an evidence-based way of thinking, a process that, you know, has changed the way that we live over the course of its development over a few thousand years. So adding the science to your story is not something extra. It's not a burden. It's not a complication. It's the heart of your argument. It's the evidence that you need in order to make your story impactful and persuasive. So it would be wrong to be in any way intimidated by the idea of incorporating science into your work. It's a tool and an amazing tool. As Janet said, I mean, nobody would be more surprised by what I've done with my career than every single science teacher I've ever had in high school or college. My grades were less than fabulous, but what my teachers would say about me, I think, is they would say, yeah, he asked a lot of questions and he was curious and he had an appreciation for the work of science, even if I didn't know how to use Avogadro's number correctly when trying to go from, you know, grams to molecules to atoms. So the first thing to really think about is that you don't have to know everything. You just need to know enough to do two things, to work science effectively into your stories. You need to be able to know enough to have an intelligent conversation with your source, and you need to have a solid background understanding of how the process of science works. It's much more important than any understanding the detailed facts and theories within a field. So what does it really mean to develop, test, and refute a hypothesis? How do scientists do their work from day to day? And what you find if you hang out with them is that there are immense commonalities, even on people who are doing work in incredibly disparate fields, people who go out in the field and people who never leave their computer. There's a way of thinking in a discipline and a process that once you start to see that, you realize that, this is a way of viewing the world that can really help my own, your own work as a journalist. So once you develop an understanding of how science works when it's done right, a key realization that flows out of that is that science is not just another opinion. You know, I'm sorry, but it isn't. And you shouldn't treat it that way. Done right, it's much more powerful than that. Done right, it's testable, falsifiable, and it carries a weight to it that can ratchet up the power and the impact of your storytelling. On the other hand, that same weight and heft can drag down your story into oblivion because science can be so dense sometimes. It can clog it up. So you have to find that balance, and you have to resort to some tools and tricks that we can talk about in this panel to incorporate the benefits of data and scientific evidence into your stories while still keeping it accessible to broad audiences. You can learn to take advantage of the narrative of science, that science is, you know, there's a reason that procedurals are, whatever, 50% of all the primetime drama on television now plus are these police procedurals that are really about a scientific process, more or less, sort of. It's a mystery-solving process. Well, that's what the scientific method is, too. And there's a drama and excitement to that that you can take advantage of. You can look for analogies and connections to popular culture. We can talk about that. You can use the familiar. You can reach your readers where they are and then establish that familiarity and then build on that to introduce unfamiliar new concepts without trivializing them or resorting to cliche. And, of course, you can look for connections to the everyday lives of your audience, which is what successful journalists do every day. So all that being said, the last point I wanted to make is that scientists are scientists. They're not heroes, or at least they're not any more or any less heroic than anyone else. They're subject to the same follies as the rest of us, maybe more so in certain ways. They're used to being the smartest people in the room often, especially the successful ones that you're more likely to interview. So they have a lot of pride. They can be arrogant. They can be greedy. And they certainly have an unwillingness to admit error. We all have that problem. So don't make the mistake of confusing the sublimity of the scientific process with your assessment of individual scientists. The process is beautiful. Scientists, well, they may or may not. Individual scientists may or may not be so beautiful. So respectful skepticism, not cynicism, but skepticism is strongly advised always. It's always in order. Never, never leave that behind. And your zeal to bring your audience the passion, the narrative, and the evidence-based power of science in your stories. So we'll leave it at that. I'll look forward to lots of good questions and discussion.
Yeah, and I think I want to start out a little bit, too, pointing out that most of us who are trained in journalism were taught, you know, if your mother says she loves you, get two independent opinions to confirm it. And the same is true in science. What sort of disturbs, I think, all of us is when someone looks at a press release or reads a paper and says, oh, this group has found X, whatever it is, and they run with it like it's true. In fact, science never answers a big question. It answers a very little piece of some pie. It just focuses on a little thing. It presents some data that should be true if you replicate a science well for these conditions, like at this temperature with this kind of mouse or tree, you know, if it's run this long, if it's this hot, if it's got this much water, whatever. You change any of those variables and things can change. And of course, those variables never resemble a universality of the world. You know, it's always a different temperature, different water level, whatever. So you've got to extrapolate, and it's in extrapolating, either when your scientists do it or we try and do it, that we get into trouble. So science gives you data. Those data should be solid and hopefully true, but what you do with those data is where we all get into trouble. On the other hand, without those data, all you've got are people guessing and pontificating. So those data are really useful, but don't treat them as like they are, you know, universal answer to anything. They are just data that were collected for a particular kind of conditions, which probably will not represent whatever we care about. And then what do you do with them? They're the best we got, but they're really not perfect. And that's the trouble we can all get into. The second thing I would bring up is that sometimes I've run into people that said they're a little allergic to science because they try and read a journal paper and they don't understand it. And it makes them feel stupid. And sometimes I would say that reflected what I felt like when I was a cub reporter, too. But in fact, most scientific papers are very poorly written. The science can be very good, but these guys aren't journalists. They aren't writers. They aren't good communicators. And you will see that when you read their papers. A few of them are clear. Most of them aren't, which is why we need to go back to the sources and ask them to talk to us in plain English. And it's why we need to find outside comment, again, from people who can speak in plain English. So don't worry if you don't understand the papers. Probably people in the field don't understand it either. And that's a sad truth about this. If you read thousands of these papers, you'll realize what kind of gibberish it reads like. It doesn't mean the data is bad. It just means these guys need a journalist to help them communicate to the world. Okay, with that, I'd like to open it up. What kind of questions might you have or observations might you have? You've got some great people up here to talk to. Ask them what you will.
Maybe while we're waiting.
Oh, no, we got some.
Oh, okay, you got one? Okay.
Yes, please. I think it's being recorded, so please.
Hello, my name is Ezra Romero. I'm a reporter for the NPR station in Fresno. I cover between Sacramento and L.A. and all of Sierra Nevada. My question is for Chris. I run into this with my editor lots of times where he doesn't want very much science in the story for a radio story. He wants like one or two facts to really deal with everything. How do you deal with that for a radio story?
Tell your editor. So the question is, your editor wants a lot of facts in order to
he wants a few, like very, very few
very
facts.
Very few facts.
To describe what's happening to the whole issue.
Yeah.
Because he wants the listener to understand. But how do you translate that for the normal audience?
Well, first you can tell your editor, no, we're not going to do that. We need several facts in here. But no, I feel your pain because I have to do that as well. And in radio, particularly in audio, you know, numbers are kind of the enemy, and so many of the facts that are important to get across from science are numerical. It's often the scientists you talk to aren't even clear themselves. In fact, now this is an opportunity to – I have some outtakes from NPR interviews in this. This might be useful to listen to. This is what people like you and I have to deal with from scientists.
I suspect the answer will be we still can't put any number on with really great confidence. I think what we feel, what people will feel, or the general consensus in the community now is the number won't be as large, or the limit on the size of the number is not a it's not an unbounded limit. I guess I'm trying to say. We don't understand the number, but we think the number will be less than what we thought we didn't understand before.
Okay. Have you ever had that? Or something akin to that? I mean, this is what turns people away from talking to scientists when they have to have a clear story. And I'm sure your editor says, can you give me an anecdote instead? Because journalism loves anecdotes. And frankly, this is a real problem. I find this a real problem in environmental journalism, is they fact-free stories, but lots of emotion and lots of anecdote. And the solution is to find, okay, as many facts as you can allow your editor to put in there in a way, in an order, in a way that's cogent and thoughtful. See if you can get a scientist to say it for you in a way that's plain and simple. If not, you often have to do the heavy lifting. Use quotes, and especially in audio again, from scientists that convey certitude, if there is certitude, or caveats, if there are caveats, emotion, passion, why it's important. You do the heavy lifting in terms of explaining mechanistic processes, statistics, because it's easier for you to say that in fewer words. It's very difficult often for people to describe complicated scientific processes. So that's the way I divide up things a lot, I'll put in the factoids and use the actualities, as we call it on radio, the taped interviews, to convey the other stuff, the why is it important, and how did you come to this conclusion, what does it mean for the public? I hope that helps.
Can I say something about
sure.
that? So this is a big problem. You know, this we have editors, or sometimes our audiences are really turned off by just flat empirical information, statistics. Data, and there are really good reasons for that. And the answer is, don't think of your data as something you just sort of stick in as part of, you know, like a laundry list. Okay, here's the data section, and let me give you some statistics about deforestation in the Sierra. That is generally the wrong way to handle empirical information within a story. Instead, what you want to do is you want to embed it smoothly in a narrative or in your argument. And that doesn't mean that you have to take a side, but that when you use a stat, you're using it in support of a specific argument or a point that someone's making. That kind of use of evidence goes down much easier than the sort of laundry list approach. Let me give you some background statistics about deforestation. That is like instant shutdown. But if you say, over the last 10 years, Mike Emmerich has noticed that there are a lot fewer cedar around. He's right. The Forest Service tells us that there's been a 40% reduction. So you're embedding the stat in the narrative, or even better, in the argument, and people are going to pay much closer attention to it under those circumstances, because you're not breaking up the flow, the argument, the narrative of your story. Don't let evidence do that. Let evidence support and strengthen your narrative. Don't let it disrupt it.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jenny Barchfield, and I'm doing the Scripps Fellowship at UC Boulder, but I was previously a longtime foreign correspondent with the AP, first in Paris, and then recently my last posting was in Rio. And I did a big story, science story, about sewage pollution problem in Rio waters, and it garnered quite a bit of attention because it was reporting that we had done on our own, testing that we had done. But the story was ginormous. I think our first installment in that series was something like 3,000 words or something, which almost never happens with the AP. And when I did subsequent installments in that series, I found it very difficult to at once maintain the nuance that I had been able to do having this larger forum in the first story, while the editors were, since it wasn't our first splash anymore, constantly pushing for reduced word count, et cetera. And I wanted to pose the question to all of you of how do you see the future of science reporting in the U.S., I guess, and maybe if you can speak to other places as well, in this age where, my own personal experience with the AP, they're constantly looking to reduce word count and get stories tighter and shorter, and, the news now that we have with the 130 words is becoming more of a norm. How can you communicate nuanced science under those sort of draconian circumstances? Thank you.
Well, I came from print, and I worked for a New Scientist magazine. And before that, I worked for McGraw-Hill. And so I went from many words to few, and where the premium is on brevity. And actually, it's good. It's better. I love it because it forces you to concentrate on what's the most important thing. And I think in a lot of stories, when you don't have a lot, you have to turn and face yourself and say, I can only get one idea across in this story. One idea. And this is certainly a rule of thumb in audio, because audio is ephemeral, and you haven't got a person's full attention most of the time. So it's gone. You can't go back and reread anything. So you reduce the number of ideas and make the deal with yourself and your editor. We're just going to tackle one thing and get it as clearly across as possible, some passion, some anecdote, some data, some facts, and something at the end, that makes people remember what it is that you've told them and why it's important, and get out. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because I think of science journalism as an iterative process. I do media training for scientists, and they often say, well, you don't get everything in the story. You don't get anything nearly or everything that's important. And I say, look, don't worry. This is an unending process, and we're going to be covering climate change for maybe another century, maybe two. And so we'll get there. I think I can't remember who it was, Rousseau or somewhere, Balzac, who said something like, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have time. It's hard to reduce, and I get reporters who come to me who've been in the business for a long time, and they say they're pitching a story, and I say, well, what's the story about? And it takes them 30 sentences, And by the 25th, I'm saying, stop, you don't have a story. If you can't reduce your story idea to one sentence, you don't know what it is. And if once you do that, it should become clear to you how to deliver the goods with the same, almost the same brevity.
Sarah?
Yeah, so as the person who actually won an award for writing short, this is something that I've done on a regular basis. I write blog posts that are under 500 words regularly. I've written, I used to write for a section of Smithsonian Magazine that covered scientific papers, a paper in less than 100 words. And the truth is, you just have to be brutal in your writing, and you have to accept that you are going to leave out something really, really interesting that your reader would love to know, but they're just not going to find out. It just has to happen. It is a hard thing to do, because you have to learn just to be really, really just brutal with your own self-editing. Since I've started editing other people, I've actually found it a lot easier to do that for myself as well. Because when you're editing other people, you don't have any attachment to the words. So you just kind of have to take that step back from your own work, and really look at it and decide what can I make shorter? Like, how can I say, you know, this thing that I spent a paragraph on, can I say it in a sentence? You know, is there, did somebody summarize this in a great quote where that I spent, you know, two paragraphs on, you know, and just you really just attack your words, in that way and little by little winnow away. And you can tell the same story that you told in 1,000 words in 500. It will be slightly different, and it will be missing some things, but it will make your editors happy.
Yeah, so three quick points. One is, yes, shorter really is better, a solid 75% of the time. As painful as it is, you know, we don't want to kill our darlings. You know, we slaved over those words, but the luxury of having an attentive editor is one that you should be excited about. And if your editor thinks it should be shorter, and not hopefully not based on any kind of formulaic reason, but based on the story itself, then you should listen to her. No doubt about it. That being said, point number two. It is wrong to say that short stories do better on the web. That's way too simplistic an analysis. And you know what does best on the web? Either stories that are, you know, are great for social media, or killer investigative stories, including really lengthy ones, do great on the web, or at least they can if they're embedded in really good narrative. So really, the key question is not, you know, whether your story is 350 words or 1,000 words or 3,000. It's, is your story any good, and does it continue to hold the reader's attention all the way through? So what we really need to do as writers and producers of stories is really sweat out our stories and make them as short as they possibly can. And if they're not short, then they should be great. And if they're great and long, they will find a terrific audience. And we should be able to have editors who are open-minded enough to recognize that this story deserves to be the length that it is. We don't always have that, but I actually think that there are enough examples out there of longer pieces that have done well, that some people's eyes are being opened up to that. And then the third point that I think is really important is you now have the ability in a digital environment to break it up, to break up your work, you know, cut it up into pieces that make sense, or tell the story in three or four different ways, you know, as a slideshow and a podcast and a text piece and a short video. So you have the ability to reach people in lots of different ways, and those ways also have the advantage of being relatively shorter. So take full advantage of this new environment that we're operating in. Don't think like you're still ink on the page, and think about ways to break up your story in ways that will make it more engaging, and also it'll go down easier because it will be relatively short.
And I want to add just one little point, too, and you can come up to the microphone. That's fine. By the way, in the back, we do have lots of seats in the front if you want. There's plenty of room up here. I think a good, tight piece, you know, very written as shortly as you can, really gets the point across really well. On the other hand, this move for shorter and shorter journalism always makes me worry that what we're moving towards is tapas journalism. And you get one little point here done well, one little point here done well, and you miss the connections and the things that show, point to trends. It's not like any little factoid is going to tell you much about our universe. It's stringing those things together. It's what we often see as those patterns and trends, and we put together as a story that makes journalists different because we're getting them from lots of different sources and lots of different places and lots of different ways, which the people who generate the data, those scientists, can't and don't do. As soon as we break them all into these little bits and pieces, you start to see things in isolation, and the point is our universe is not in isolation. And so that's one of those things I always worry about. We shouldn't be writing longer than we need to, but we should find and report patterns whenever we do, because those patterns are often amazingly illustrative, and they get us thinking about problems or solutions. So just another point to keep in mind. The editors are not likely to be really sympathetic to that, but we need to keep that in mind, that we don't end up, you know, developing a whole industry of tapas journalism.
And again, the great thing about a digital environment is that we can take advantage of linking to create, you know, to avoid the lack of context that Janet's decrying. But every story does not have to answer, you know, every question. In a digital environment, you can package stories and put stories together in different storytelling ways. Each of them more or less stands on their own, but the full context comes from the broader presentation. So let's take advantage of that.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. My name is Vivi Siegel, and I'm here from CDC, from the National Center for Environmental Health. I have a journalism background, and I'm thrilled to be here to be asking a question of this panel, and that there are so many people here. And I have a question coming from my current role at CDC. And I think a lot of you are saying people look for science to explain things and to have the answers. A lot of time in the field of environmental health, science doesn't have the answers. As I know, Dan for sure knows, and the rest of you who have looked at instances where people want to know that a certain exposure, an environmental exposure, has caused a certain disease. It's very, very difficult to prove and to draw a clear line between an exposure and a disease. And sometimes the best that science can say is we don't know and we're never going to know. So how can we work together, government or whoever the scientists are, work with journalists to help express that uncertainty when people are always looking for certainty and there's pressure from community or editors to have those clear answers and when we don't have them?
This is a subject that's very dear to my heart. And I haven't covered this part of science for a while, but I come across it a lot at NPR. I get reporters offering me stories. And they may be about it. So, okay, it's about a refinery. And they open with an anecdote because journalists and their editors love anecdotes. So it's a mom and her kid on the playground, and the kid's got asthma. I moved here a year ago, and my kid got asthma. It must be the refinery. And by the way, my brother-in-law down the street has liver cancer. I mean, it's got to be the refinery. The reporter starts with that and then moves on to something completely different. No attempt at verification. Did you talk to the family's doctors? Did you talk to the state epidemiologist? Has anybody done any environmental toxicology research in the published literature? They don't bother. And this gets the spike right away. And it's all too prevalent in environmental journalism, and I think it's a real problem. But I understand it because people want anecdotes, they want the human part of the story, and also tracking down all that stuff is hard, and there's no answer, because for a lot of exposures, we don't have the answers. What I ask people to do is say, find what's available. Are there, for example, in a lot of exposures, there's data about occupational exposure, which is much easier to find. So go find that. Go to Go to organizations like CDC or OSHA, because they have that data. Really make the effort. If you can't make the effort, don't give me the anecdote, because you're implicitly you're giving non-scientists a platform to state science, and that's wrong. It's fine to have them in there, but then you have to do the hard work. And ultimately, lastly, is like, find out if somebody is at least doing some research. I mean, a recent story, I went back to the reporter and I said, well, is anybody even bothering to study this? And he said, well, yeah, there's a scientist at the local university who's actually working with this community and has just started an NIH-funded grant to find out what the exposures could possibly be doing. I said, well, put that in. At least say, we know there's no evidence yet that this is there's a connection here, but the people are suspicious and they're trying to find out.
And I love your comment about dealing with uncertainty. I've been on a soapbox for years saying that it is our job as journalists generally to cultivate uncertainty, that there is so few things in our universe that are certain and true. Maybe the end, you know, the score on a baseball game. But, you know, short of something like that, almost nothing is unambiguously true and maybe not even unambiguously false. So it's always context dependent, and we do everybody a disservice when, with our topless journalism or whatever, or, you know, lazy reporting, or there's not enough time to do something, we go and leave out a lot of the stuff, the caveats that point out that something is not unambiguously true or false. We should be saying that we don't know for certain, and we should, you know, nobody likes to live with uncertainty. You know, you want to go and put in your head, this factoid is true, you put it away, you know, in hard drive, and you don't have to worry about it. Carrying it around in RAM, all that uncertainty, is really disconcerting for us. Too bad. That's what the world is like. It's uncertain. We don't know. And we need, as journalists, to not pretend things are more cut and dry than they are. And that's what science is good for. It points out all those things that seem, those niggling little things that suggest that maybe this isn't always true, that maybe it's a little worse, or certain people may be more vulnerable or whatever. But it's our job, I think, to sort of point out how the world is uncertain and we do ourselves and everybody else an injustice by pretending it's black and white.
And I think what we're doing our readers a disservice if we just kind of gloss over the uncertainties. There's a lot of people out there who are very distrustful of science, of environmentalism, of these things, and it's part because we say that things are certain when they're not. One of the things I try to always do when I'm writing about science is to explain how the scientists came to the conclusion that they did, and then why that might not be true. It's actually a very easy thing to do, because in a lot of scientific articles, they actually have big sections in which they discuss why their results might not be true, and that section is not to be skipped over, because there can be some really important information in there. And you know, your readers, even my readers now who are middle school kids, they can handle uncertainty. You know, they don't have to have everything spelled out for them, and so I think that it's really important that we do just point that out.
They don't like it, and editors don't like it, but so be it.
Right. So, as you implied, if anybody's looked at my work for the last 20 years, you know that I'm completely obsessed with this topic of how to deal with uncertainty, especially in the context of toxics. And so I have thought about it a lot. One of the big problems, I think, is that I don't know, as you said, that's not a helpful answer for journalists or for readers. But what is a helpful answer is, well, we certainly aren't sure. Here's what we do know, and here are the range of uncertainties associated with the data that we have. So that's the helpful answer. And what we have to do is somehow get past the sort of binary you know, there are two choices in a story. Either something is true or something is total BS, and we should either write that it's BS or just not do the story in the first place. And we see this conflict all the time between people who come to these stories from a science background versus people who come to these stories from an environmental background or sometimes an environmentalist background. You know, that there are errors made on both sides, that sometimes people who have a really strong science background, you know, assume that because, you know, as Popper taught us, that science can't prove anything, it can only falsify. That's how science moves forward. Therefore, you know, really most journalism about risk is worthless because, after all, how can we be sure of anything? And so sometimes these writers, these journalists, are way too quick to either ignore stories or knock them down as just silly and unproven. And, of course, on the other side, we have folks who are just totally driven by anecdotes or by their ideology and either assume that bad data is good data or somehow proof, or just don't even bother with the data at all and just tell their stories with anecdotes. Both of those approaches are wrong, wrong, wrong. And so what we have to do is figure out how to communicate risk accurately to audiences, but also in a way that they will get it. You know, that you know, again, by embedding it within an argument or within a narrative, that they'll pay attention to the nuances that Janet and Sarah were talking about. That we need those nuances, but we can't do it in a kind of a pandering way that tells the reader, A, you don't have the sophistication to understand, you know, the subtlety here, or B, you're only interested in true or false. I don't think that's true. I think readers are smarter than that. If you treat them as thinking, you know, rational people, and if you give them the respect of really doing your hard work and your storytelling, so if you do the hard work and you embed. You embed your information within a narrative, then it is perfectly possible to communicate risk accurately and avoid that binary choice.
And as Chris was pointing out with that waffling quote before, people usually don't know a solid number. But the number, if you don't know what it is, it's not like possibly 1 or 2 trillion. I mean, there's a very narrow band for which the data fit. And so, you know, showing how constrained it is, it may not be this, but it can't be more than this, tells people a lot. And that's what we as journalists need to do. Find out what are the error bars on those data, how, you know, and even if it could be anywhere from 1 to 100, it's probably going to be closer to 15. That's telling people a lot, you know, and it's also being honest. So that's what we should be trying to do. But sometimes I think we either try and give them it's 15, or we say nobody knows. And that's in some sense true, but also worthless information. The data do give you some error bars.
Nobody ever knows anything. Right?
Especially journalists.
It's not about knows.
This isn't about journalism. This is epistemology 101.
Deep, thank
deep
you
stuff.
All.
Question, but a quick anecdote referring to the length issue here. I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star, and every month our paper gives us analytics now, so we know how many page views, how many users we have for every story that we write. And in August, I had like a half dozen Sunday type and big daily type stories, and by far the one that got the most page views and the most users was 3,000 words long, which in this day and age is like humongous, and it was a narrative about a jaguar. It wasn't really a science piece. But in any case, it was almost twice as much as any of the others. So I went up to my team leader and said, look at this. See, people do read these. And so what she says is, first thing, but how much do they read? We know they don't read the whole thing. Yeah. And that's what you deal with editors. Okay, you can't really win. My question is something that Janet and I have discussed on the list, but I'd like to get other people's takes on this, which is, you're doing a study on research, and it's a decent study or a big study that's either page one or top of the metro page or whatever the equivalent is on air or online. And how much information do the readers need about if it's really newsworthy and potentially controversial, about how the conclusions were reached, what kind of research methods were used, and secondly, how many quotes are good to have from people who are familiar with the subject but didn't participate in the study, because I see things all over the lot on that when I read stories. So that's my question.
Who wants to take it?
Yeah, so Tony, those are really good questions. And the classic answer, which is accurate but frustrating, is, well, it depends on the story. Just as length, there, you know, it's silly to prescribe any kind of sort of set length guideline for any story, because some stories deserve more and some don't. And it's always going to be a subjective process. But that being said, I'm a lot more worried and focused on getting independent experts, independent analysts in my story than I am in, you know, doing the equivalent of the methods section of a science paper, making sure that all that is in my story. I usually find that in a medium-length story, a, you know, 1,000-word story or whatever, you can put a couple of paragraphs on methods, and that's fine. Sometimes the method is really interesting, and so when that happens, that's great. Then it could be part of your narrative. But getting independent experts, independent analysts who are familiar with, as you said, Tony, familiar with, but not directly involved with the work, the research that you're writing about, is absolutely essential, and it's malpractice to do a story without them.
Just a couple of corollaries. If a story is controversial at all, then that puts a premium on getting other points of view. I do some gee whiz stories that you know, as hard as I look, I can't really find any controversy. I don't mind not going to outside experts usually. However, another thing that's very important, and this has given the science desk a reputation, is the evil empire at NPR, because a lot of the times our job is to say no. And it'll be something in the New York Times even, or something in BBC, I won't insult anybody here, but, there's some, you'll see a story and our All Things Considered editor will come over and say, shouldn't we do this? And we say, no, and here's why. And then we'll go to other experts to prove our point. So sometimes I go to other experts sometimes who tell me, don't do the story. It's really bad, even if it's in a journal. And if I get two or three people who tell me that, I may just not do the story, or do the story and trash it, and trash the research, which I don't like to do very often. But in any case, there are lots of reasons to go to other experts. That should cover it.
Generally, I found that the more outside experts I've been able to interview, the better the story. The problem is, especially I've discovered the 4 years that I was freelancing, is that in order to do things like pay rent, you just often don't have that luxury. You have to be churning out so much work that if you can get a hold of one outside expert, you have to make that do. I think that's kind of a sorry state of journalism right now, we're not paying especially the freelance reporters, enough money to do the kind of journalism that should be done. And I don't have any good answers on how to change that.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Glazner. I'm an independent journalist. And I wanted to ask if, as writers, any of you would care to comment on your fact-checking methodology. And also, have you ever... Let's see, how do I want to phrase this? Have you ever... come up with a metaphor that you absolutely love, but you're not sure it's correct, and sent that to a source? That's my question.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, it's important for metaphors to be short, powerful, but most of all, sort of I think of it as a one-to-one relationship. If you're using a metaphor to describe a scientific process or phenomenon, I mean, it should be properly parallel to that phenomenon. It shouldn't. A messy metaphor is not a good thing to do. It does disservice to reality. That said, they're really hard to find. Metaphors are, by nature, by definition, not exact copies of what you're describing. So you can then use the metaphor and then build out from it to make sure that people understand exactly what you meant by it. In terms of fact-checking, scientists are brutal. when it comes to, you know, sciences are very detail-oriented. So if you get something wrong, you believe me that you're going to hear it. I fact check as much as I can, but you know, a lot of the times, you know, you use the notion that something's in a peer-reviewed journal as well. That's my first line of fact checking. It's been through peer review, so it must be pretty decent. And I do. There's a hierarchy. I mean, you know, there are journals and stuff that's not peer reviewed. So I'm doubly skeptical. But the thing is that peer review is not perfect, and there's a lot of junk that gets into journals. I think more so all the time because they're motivated too to get stuff that's sexy.
Or do it fast. And so,
you know, if you're, say, for example, dealing with, I don't know if you write stuff from journals, but if you want to, the good way to find people to check it is to, in the journal, look at the citations at the bottom and find who they cited, and then find those people and talk to them, and keep a record of every scientist you talk to and who they are and what their discipline is, and then when you get a story, whether it's a journal story or not, you have your own peer reviewers. I mean, I've got lots of them, and I call them up all the time. And that helps tremendously because I can't vet everything from archaeology to zoology. I don't know all that stuff. So depend on your sources.
So I actually spent I've done fact-checking for several magazines over the years. And so one of the things is I would never go back and check quotes with people, but every other fact, when I was at Smithsonian, for example, every other line in an article had to be checked with a source, with somebody, and occasionally I would just find a professor who's taught in that area and who would help me understand what was in there and then understand whether it was right, because he's right, you know, I've got a background in ecology, but if there's something with astrophysics in front of me, I still have to figure that out and whether it's right. And, you know, scientists are just really helpful. They seem like they're really scary people. They're not. The majority of them aren't. There's a few that are. for the most part, they're more than willing to help. And one of the things that whenever I'm contacting scientists and I'm asking for help, I was like, if you can't help me directly, if you don't have time, can you suggest people? And generally, then I get a boatload of others, and somebody will invariably be more than willing to get on the phone with me and just talk about something, whatever I need to know.
In our shop, getting a factoid wrong is close to a hanging offense. You're not supposed to let that happen. And because we're a science publication and the people we've cited are scientists and they know who we are, they're going to get back if we made a mistake. So we will always hear, sometimes from 25 to 50 people, if we get something wrong. It's very embarrassing. So it's in our vested interest to make sure we make as few mistakes as possible. The place where we get into trouble, if we have a direct quote from somebody and they really said that, they're on the line now if they got that wrong. Okay? That's how we live with it. They're on the line. The problem is in paraphrasing. And when you try and paraphrase someone, because they gave you a waffling quote, like Chris, you know, gave, and you're trying to make some sense out of it or whatever, you can get into trouble. And, I mean, one of those things that I found, for example, my background was physics. I really didn't understand chemistry all that well. I didn't know there's a difference between absorb and adsorb. And especially you don't hear it much in a telephone interview, the difference between absorb and adsorb. And so I heard absorb, and it was not. It was adsorb. And got it wrong, and it just taught me you have to pay a lot of attention, and I got into the habit of finding out where all my sources for a story were going to be about 10 minutes before deadline. And when I have that last draft, if I'm sure that the quote was what they said, that's fine. But if I'm paraphrasing, I will go back and contact them, maybe while they're waiting to catch a plane in an airport or when they're, you know, visiting their grandmother and, you know, to go on a picnic or something, whatever it is, I'd find out where they are and make sure that I got that right. So you can do a lot to fact check yourself. It's very embarrassing if you let your readers fact check you.
Right, it's a disaster when that happens. That you know, I mean, I know some web reporters that say, "Oh, we'll just put it out there," and you know, the comments will catch up to any errors, and You know, that's when we know we'll be officially at the end of our business, when that becomes the standard process, that kind of crowdsourcing of fact. Right. So the art of fact-checking as sort of a separate discipline of journalism is slowly dying. You know, the economics of our business are making that untenable. So increasingly, you have to be your own fact-checker. And really, if you're a decent journalist, you are always your own best fact checker from the start. You would never want to rely on someone else. So I encourage everyone that I've ever worked with, you know, 1,000-plus people, to maximize their dialogue with their interview folks, doing everything except sharing the text itself. So that means at the end of the interview, going through the conversation again, saying, you know, I want to make sure I understand a few things. Here's a point that you made. You said this, then you said that. Not reading back the quotes, but talking about the heart of the conversation to make sure that you have that right. I encourage everyone to always get back to sources multiple times, not in an annoying way, but in a sensible way, if at all possible. And thirdly, I wanted to plug a friend of mine, Brooke Burrell, just is about to publish a new, really the best fact-checking guide ever, published by the University of Chicago, the University of Chicago fact-checking something. Anyway, it's really good, and Brooke is great. She teaches in my program. Brooke, B-O-R-E-L. And she's wonderful. On the subject of metaphor, or analogy, just one more quick thing, and that is all of my students, unless they were asleep that day, know that I have a four points that are really important. I'm all for analogy wherever possible, but it needs to be apt, as we heard. It has to actually fit. It needs to be concise so it doesn't distract. It needs to be sort of get in and out fast. It needs to be non-cliched so it's not boring. And fourth, it has to be, this is the one that usually trips people up, it has to be nearly universally understood. You know, whatever you're analogizing to can't be something so obscure that a significant part of your readership doesn't understand it. But if you can click all four of those boxes, apt, concise, non-cliched, and nearly universally understandable, then by all means, put those analogies in there.
One thing, too, when you asked about fact-checking, don't let another publication be your fact-checking guide. I can't tell you how many times someone has said, oh, you know, the New York Times covered it, and they got it right. I said, they got it all right, and they said yes. And then I'll check 5 points from there, and every one of them was wrong. And they said, well, yeah, they did get that one wrong. But up until then, they said it was right. Because they were so happy it got into the New York Times. So you just have to realize that lots of us make little tiny mistakes, and, you know, in isolation, they're not a big deal. But if you use that as your fact check, you know, you're just going to multiply the effect. So always check on your own for any number or idea or quote or whatever, date that you're using, spelling that you're using.
Yeah, and books aren't fact-checked for the most part either. So, yeah, be careful using those for any of your facts, newspaper, magazine articles. When I was a fact-checker, I was kind of appalled at the number of times journalists, very respected journalists, cited things like Wikipedia and Yahoo Answers. It just meant that I went on a wild goose chase for a real fact.
Right. Yep. Press releases, yeah. NGO websites. Yeah. I don't care how much you love NRDC, they get stuff wrong. Yeah. Or they cherry pick, just as much as any corporation cherry picks the sites.
Never, ever rely on anyone else to check your facts for you. And whether that's an editor or a fact checker, or whether it's some secondary source, like another piece of journalism or an advocacy group, it's not reliable. Wikipedia, I just want to say a word about Wikipedia. Everyone likes to dump on Wikipedia for good reason. Wikipedia has its uses. You can never rely on Wikipedia, but early in the process, Wikipedia can be helpful, just as general Google searches can be helpful. So let's not completely dismiss the idea of Wikipedia.
No, the source list at the end of the articles is absolutely wonderfully useful.
Thank you for waiting.
Just a note, Google ranks Wikipedia very low in SEO, so it's not good for your articles to ever link to Wikipedia for that reason, too. I have a question about industry funding of science. I'm working on a story right now where a researcher published a piece of science bearing a university's School of Public Health logo on a corporate website. I'm saying that there's no negative health impacts of coal-fired power plants near Edmonton. And initially, the company had a disclosure that they had funded the study, and then they disappeared that disclosure. So we did a FOIA to the university and found out that the company had, in fact, paid $54,000 to that, and they named that particular individual researcher. And it's been a sort of a tricky story to report on because as far as the university and now the corporation describe it, they did in fact come up with a sponsorship agreement, but then they decided not to use those funds for that particular study. But the university still kept the money. And so it raises complications about the way science is funded and how when we talk about science, it's so not a level playing field. There's all sorts of kinds of science. But in this particular instance, I ended up interviewing someone named Gary Gray, and he worked at Harvard Center for Ethics and did this like big anonymous study with researchers who received industry funding to talk to them about if their findings were influenced. And from his perspective, industry funding absolutely does, not because it corrupts methodology necessarily, but because researchers and scientists are people too, and so they might choose to kind of sort of exclude that one question from what they're going to look at just to avoid the hot water and maybe to get funding again in the future. So for me, I mean, I don't want to create unnecessary doubt about the way science is produced in universities, but it raises these like really troubling questions about the way money is funneled into universities to pay for this kind of research that in some cases ends up being peer-reviewed too. So, yeah, any tips you have for how to navigate that and how to report on it and, like, how the scientific institutions themselves see that kind of the way that money flows and influences science? Or tell us how to understand that. Thanks.
Well, I think you started out right by an extra level or two or three of skepticism. I mean, for myself anyway, and this is, you know, I think varies from person to person, I don't automatically dismiss out of hand research that's funded, especially if it's two or three degrees of separation from the scientist himself or herself. But I level a lot more skepticism about it. In your case, I would really work hard to find other people who have done similar research to find out what their findings were and if they differ from this. And also, from my point of view, I've also found that you need to level the same kind of skepticism from money that comes from the left, from NGOs and from foundations. And I've done some of this same sort of investigation into people who, for example, are in the anti-fracking community or in the anti-GMO community who have received money from foundations whose, you know, IRS forms show something about where they spend the money, where they get their money, and they have agendas too. They have agendas that are, I think, as powerful as the agenda of a corporation. It's not for profit, but it's still an agenda. So I think it's great to look at where the money comes from, but apply it across the board.
And one reason you want to look at where money comes from is because not necessarily that someone is going to go and give you bogus data as a result of getting industry funding, but industry may see the handwriting that you're veering in a, you know, dose response curve towards something that's going to look problematic, and so they decide to cut off the study at that point. So there will be no data that show the problematic findings because they've just ended it. The people can't write anything about that because they don't have any data to support what's going to happen. It doesn't have to happen, but there have been cases where that has happened. And so it just shows there are ways to manipulate things short of actually lying about the data. You can sort of change the dynamic or the design of a study so that it cannot show something. If you know the effects are going to happen in week 8, you cut it off at week 7, you know, and then say, oh, we saw no effect. Those kinds of things do happen. You can't assume they're happening, but that's why we need to at least put a disclosure that this work was funded by whatever.
Right. Just two points about that. I feel like I've spent my whole career writing about industry-funded science and the issues associated with that. But all that being said, I would never, ever automatically dismiss industry-funded science. And I would never fail to talk to industry or a relevant environmental group in any of my work. Why? Because the people who care most about the topic also have usually know the most. Of course, the information that they give you is problematic. You have to be extremely skeptical about it, and that's why it becomes so crucial to find the closest to independent experts you could find help you analyze that data and help you figure out what's going on. But just because industry funds something, or just because NRDC funds something, or whoever, doesn't mean that you should ignore that data. What it does mean is that you have to subject it to independent analysis, a lot of it. And number two, just as importantly, you must make level with your readers about where the funding for that science has come from. And the second sin is just as important as the first, you know. You not only must check that data with independent experts, you must disclose funding, you know. And what really upsets me is the circumstance that you, our questioner, described, which is when there was essentially a secret source of funding. And when that happens, well, I get even more excited and more imperative to disclose funding sources. But I never, never automatically dismiss data, no matter where it comes from. The reality is that we would all love it if you know, we were all flooded with independent data from people who aren't biased. But this is the system that we have, and we can keep trying to fight for a better system of science funding. But the trend lines are going the opposite direction. We're having more special interest funded science, not less. So we have to accommodate ourselves to this world by doing those two things.
That's right. Money is tight in science, and sometimes the only source of funds will be industry funds, which means the only source you're going to have of data will come from that route. As imperfect as it may be, we can't ignore it. We just have to be skeptical. Yeah.
My name is Laurel Rogers. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey, California Water Science Center. Here in California, we have a couple hundred scientists working on California water issues. So there's probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 that are, you know, the really high level, have been there for years and years. And I know you'd mentioned, Janet, that a lot of the scientists are kind of down in the weeds, and you're going to have to kind of, you know, pull out the data and figure out where that fits. But I really liked what you'd mentioned as saying, Dan, that you really went back and talked to the scientists a lot, because those scientists, my job is to try and prepare them to talk to you guys. And they're afraid. They're afraid of you, you know. And
sometimes we're afraid of them, too.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that giving them a little time and a little bit of context to what you're looking for, because those scientists have the context. You were saying they have that big picture context. They're hydrologists. They're biologists. They are looking at that world all the time. So to me, it feels like getting to the root of what they know on the big picture level and asking those bigger questions is really important. Anyway, so that's just my... But one of the questions I had for you guys is, so when this, you know, from your perspective, what's the best way for a scientist to, you know, if you can give them more than a few minutes ahead of time, which would be really great, so they can think about it for a minute and pull themselves out of that well they're in down there. What's the best way for them to start, you know, preparing for what you guys are going to ask?
I can actually play a little outtake here that'll give you an example. It might be amusing. Okay. Of an interview. This is an NPR outtake interview with a Nobel Prize winner. Just listen to this.
Could you just describe, and speak up if you can, describe as simply as you can your contribution, what you're getting the Nobel Prize for?
Well, the citation is for the theoretical work I did in connection with the new phases of liquid helium-3, which were discovered experimentally in the early 70s. The experimental work has, in fact, received a Nobel Prize to Osherov, Richardson, and Lee. That I think was in 1996. What I did was basically to take the existing theory of superconductivity as developed by John Bardeen and his co-workers here at UIUC and apply it in a somewhat more sophisticated form to the new phases of helium-3, assuming that that basically what was happening in superfluid helium-3 was much the same as is happening in superconductors, namely that you find pairs of particles coming together to form a sort of diatomic molecule, and that diatomic molecule then undergoes a funny kind of transition in which all the molecules have to behave in exactly the same way.
All right. Did you get that? That was in you didn't hear the beginning, but this reporter said, just briefly tell me what you won the Nobel Prize for. The one part of the interview that was used, one answer was used out of the entire. What did you use the money for that you won, the prize money? So you get that a lot. I do media training for scientists. I've done about 40 of them with Compass. And this is typical. There's several things going on here, and that's what you're going to have to deal with when you try to deal with your scientists and how to speak plain English. The first thing he did was talk about the shoulders of giants on which he stood, which he's talking to his peers. Scientists care about their peers. They don't understand that we don't care about their peers. They're just worried to death that their peers are going to make fun of them or they'll say something stupid. So that's the first fear they got to get over. You know, he's crediting all these people who came before him. That was one sentence. Keep no jargon, please. Simple declarative sentences. Know your audience. There's a whole, I won't go through the whole list, but there's a book called Escape from the Ivory Tower, and it's about how scientists can communicate better. And they desperately want to. They don't know how. Some know they don't know. You know, there are known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns. But, you know, there's a way out of it. There's a methodology here, and it's teachable. And
but it also helps to have the reporters asking those questions, going back to the question several times.
Well, yes, and also, I mean, just to have a conversation, sometimes they're trying to seem smart, to seem sort of, you know, clever. And what works well is when they just start talking to you, like they talk over a fence. And so if you try and get it in a 3-minute interview, it ain't going to happen. But if you're on the phone with them for like 30, 40 minutes, and an average interview for me with a PI might be 40 to 60 minutes, there will be 15 to 20 minutes in there where it's the over-the-fence kind of conversation. And I can ask anything. I say, but I didn't quite follow that. It sounds like this. Do you really mean that? And they go, no, sorry about that. What? And then they'll back up and they'll give it to you in English. And, you know, it just takes a while. And that I can't tell you how many times at the end of the interview they said, wow, that was like a really fun conversation. And that's it. It was a conversation. It wasn't like they were on, you know, the defense. It ended up being a conversation. And that's what I think we, when we do a good job, we pull things out of them by having a conversation. We guide the conversation. They have the data. We figure out how to get it from them. And when they stumble, we tell them they're stumbling, and we work with them on it.
I think it is just important to recognize, too, that scientists are are helping us out and to make it as easy as possible for them to talk to us. So I very rarely, because I don't usually write on very strict deadlines here. I have a few days at least to advance notice. So I have time to email scientists beforehand, and I always tell them who I'm writing for, what I'm writing about, why I contacted them, giving them time periods. So can I talk to you on this day at the, you know, around this time? And if you're not available, who would you recommend of your colleagues for me to talk to? And that really seems to ease the way so that they also have time to Google me and find out that I'm legit and that I'm not out to get them, because that's what a lot of them are worried about. They've been burned in the past.
The psychology of the interview is that you're both overcoming a kind of mutual suspicion. And so what you really want to do as a reporter, and the source too, if the source is savvy, wants to do this too, is to sort of build trust. And the way to build trust is to take a little bit of time where you can. And as Janet said, to reach the point where it's actual conversation. And there's a feeling that there's somehow a shared mission. There isn't really a shared mission, but there almost is, in the sense that there's a shared mission in the sense that you're both trying to depict reality as closely as you can. And in reality, in truth, you will never actually reach that exact reality. But the more time you get and the more conversational the interview is, then everyone sort of relaxes. The source ends up telling you what she really thinks. You feel more comfortable asking uncomfortable questions. And everybody winds up with a better experience. So that really should be the goal. And the goal, what you really want to try to get away from, is the idea that the interview is somehow a performance. It's not a performance. It's a conversation.
Or that you're trying to catch someone. They don't want to be caught. Like, right, we're out there somehow trying to find that they did something wrong or that they're stupid or whatever, you know, or that we're going to really mischaracterize what they've done. So if you have that conversation and they can see you're really trying to understand what's going on, then they'll open up and they'll help you. It's when you try in that quick in and out, or, you know, you're sort of brusque and whatever, there's reason they can be suspicious of you. And you just get so much more out of these people when you're working together towards a goal, which is understanding.
Hi, Lee Levitt, freelance journalist, and I currently write for a KQED science column. So my question stems from this issue around the, you know, decrease in funding for basic science and also for science that doesn't have agendas attached, possibly. And how would you recommend, you know, going about doing the homework first to understand how to read a scientific article in terms of the standard protocols that are followed? You know, I asked that having spent a year on an investigative piece on an organophosphate that has been implicated in affecting brain development. And, you know, there's been a lot of epidemiological research, but, you know, the science that was, you know, sent by the company to the US EPA, you know, had some flaws. And it wasn't until I, you know, talked to a lot of people and really tried to look and see what were those, you know, what were those deviations from standard practice. You know, it's not the Sprague dolly rats they used. It's the other kind. And so that's the kind of stuff that if we're not scientists, we don't know that they're deviating from certain standard protocols. So how would you recommend kind of getting...
You talk to outside comment. You get other people. You can't know those things. There's no hope. So you let someone else say they used the wrong mouse because of this, or they didn't... Normally, you'd see effects in the third or fourth month, and they only did it for 6 weeks, so I don't know what to expect. Or they looked at the wrong neuron, and this is why. You let those people be the ones that do it. You can't know anything. And frankly, I wouldn't even worry about doing all that homework ahead of time. If you're working on, you know, deadline, you don't have that. You just have to go in and, what did you do on this study? What did you show, and how did you do it? And then you run it by other people and say, was that reasonable?
Yeah.
And if they're in the same field, they're going to have as good an idea as anyone, certainly far more than you. Don't worry about whether you would know this. It's not your job to know this, but to find people who do.
Don't make the young reporter's common mistake of feeling like you have to immerse yourself in the literature for a long period of time before you begin talking to experts. Mm-hmm. The literature is probably not going to help you. You only need two things, like I said, to do a successful interview with a scientist. You need to have a basic understanding sufficient to have an intelligent conversation, intelligent first conversation. And secondly, you have to have some understanding of how science works. But you can't possibly know, you know, the full tox data on OP. There's too much. There's too much. And even if there was something that you could read, you wouldn't pick up on the subtleties. You can only get that by identifying those independent experts and reaching out to them and doing it early in the process, not just at the very end.
I would disagree slightly in the sense that there is one field that would behoove you to be familiar with, if not a master of, because it's the part of science that's universal. It can be in astronomy. It's in zoology. It's in anthropology, and that's statistics. Now, I didn't study statistics, but you can find out all you need as a journalist. There's a book, a wonderful book called News and Numbers by Victor Cohn. There's another good book called A Field Guide to Science Writing. And you don't have to be a statistician, but if you can understand some basic principles about incidence and prevalence and correlations, not causation, and how to, and what's the coefficient of correlation, what is it? You don't have to calculate it, but to understand what's medically significant rather than statistically significant. They're not the same, you know, because there's something, some toxin is found at a statistically significant level does not mean that it's medically significant. These are things that will help you ask the right questions of these outside experts that you go to. And it's not that complicated.
I do agree with that, but I would just say don't make the mistake of assuming that you know, your own grasp of statistics is sufficient, because every circumstance is different. Statistics are not quite a universal language in science. Depending on what kind of data set you're dealing with, the rules are not necessarily universal, nor are the standards for journalism exactly the same as statistical significance, nor do scientists have a clear understanding of a clear agreement on what statistical significance actually is, whether it's a bright line, should we take a Bayesian approach. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement about that. So I certainly,
but you have to know about statistics to know that.
Yeah, that's true. I certainly agree with you that it's really helpful to have a basic grounding in statistics, but never assume that your statistical knowledge is sufficient for a particular story, because it will not be.
I think this has to be the last question, because we're over at this point. But
okay. Jack Leonard from Unilever. I feel like an interloper here because I am one of those scientists that people interview. I was on a panel earlier this morning. Just listening to the comments, and I thought it was very helpful. When we get a request for an interview, from my point of view, I always do research on who that person is. So if it's Sarah or Dan, I will do everything I can to find out what your position is, what questions are you likely to ask. We're a very competitive bunch, just like we do a competitor. I will do an entire portfolio of all your work to understand where you're coming from. What knowledge do you have? I look up your education, what courses you've taught, what courses you've taken. Do you do that?
Yes.
To the person you're talking to.
Yes,
and then one other comment on Chris. The most important course I took once I got out of grad school was media training. It has allowed me to actually do this type of thing almost for a living, where I go out and I testify in front of various state legislatures, but also write pieces for other people. And then lastly, I got my PhD in chemistry from Northwestern. My thesis advisor at that time said, you're not a chemist until you learn how to communicate it. I've never forgotten that, because so many people, I see it in my own organization, they do great work. They have no idea how to tell people accurately and precisely. So,
yeah, I mean, just to put an exclamation point on that, a journalist friend of mine once said, you know, sometimes scientists complain that we didn't get the story right because they didn't tell us what it was, so we had to make up one ourselves. I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, it's, I would not call it a it's not a right, the right word, a collaboration, but there is this, we need to get from scientists something that we can bite into. And if we leave confused, then that's to your detriment as well as ours. And the better that we understand what you're doing, the better we can communicate to the public what's going on in the scientific community.
Can I say one thing about that? Do we have time?
We don't, but go ahead.
The subject of media training has come up a few times, and media training is ultra important. We certainly appreciate it from the journalist's point of view. On the other hand, media training assumes a model that is increasingly not the dominant model for communication of empirical information, and that is that, generally speaking, now journalists are less important than we used to be, as painful as that is to recognize. So I feel really strongly that a big part of the future of science communication is going to involve scientists learning to tell stories well to larger audiences. And journalists are very much a part of that. Sometimes that will be in loose collaboration, as awkward as that can be sometimes. So we have a big program at NYU that's now 10 years old, and we've trained more than 500 scientists in the basics of how not just to deal with reporters or understand what reporters need, but how to communicate directly to broad audiences. And that also needs to be a really important way going forward, that we journalists think about the big picture of science communication, because sometimes it's not going to involve us at all. And so it's incumbent on us to try to get the folks who are leaving us out in that direct communication. It's incumbent on us to try to get them to embrace journalistic values like fairness and transparency and verification. And so we're fighting really hard to make that happen.
So let's give a thank you to our speakers here.